from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning in our opening hour, Proposition C on San Francisco's June ballot would require that 25% of units in new large and medium-sized residential buildings be offered at below-market prices. If passed, the measure would make San Francisco the city with the most stringent affordable housing mandate in the nation. But some housing advocates say that with the high cost of construction and real estate prices, the measure could deter investors and actually stymie housing growth. We'll talk about it, debate it, next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. In this morning's opening Forum hour, as part of our ongoing election coverage, we take up debate and discussion of Proposition C, an initiative on the June 7th ballot. Co-authored by Supervisors Jane Kim and Aaron Peskin, Prop C would raise the current 12% affordable inclusionary housing requirement put on market-rate housing to 25%. The measure has received unanimous support from the Board of Supervisors as well as the mayor, while some housing advocates and developers have expressed serious concerns about it. We discuss it in this opening hour of Forum. We're going to have a whole panel with us, but first we're going to talk to Stephanie Martin Taylor, who is here with us, anchor and housing reporter for KQED. Welcome, Stephanie.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Let's find out about this amendment. I mean, it will be on the ballot, and it includes, as I said, new, large, and medium-sized housing, and it's going to be inclusionary to the extent of 25%. That's the biggest in the whole nation.
It is, yes. That would really be very groundbreaking. Now, it's important to know that 25% is not necessarily set in stone. Just a little bit of background on Proposition C. Currently, the city's charter requires developers of larger housing projects to set aside 12% of the units on site for below market rate housing. Now, Prop C argues that 12% affordable housing rate is far too low right now, given the state of the housing market and our housing crisis. But the board really can't do anything about it. It is locked right now in the city's charter, which is essentially our city constitution. So if you want to change the rate of affordable housing included in developments, you have to go to voters. So Prop C is basically asking voters to take the city's affordable housing requirements out of the charter altogether and give the Board of Supervisors the power to raise and lower the affordable housing rate. Also, if voters approve this charter amendment, then the on-site requirement for developers more than doubles to 25%. 15% will be designated for low-income residents, and this is important, 10%, and this is very new for San Francisco, will have to be designated for middle-income earners.
This is a big shift of power to the Board of Supervisors, but it also would, for the first time, require some middle-income housing, yeah?
Yes, that's correct. So that is a major shift. Now, that 25% is not set in stone. There's trailing legislation that basically says that a feasibility analysis has to be performed at least every 3 years. So the board will continue revisiting its requirements.
It's going to be doing something by the end of July, too, isn't
it? Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So it's not really clear whether that will actually be what sticks.
And could you talk about the grandfathering here? Because that's kind of changed the whole landscape of this, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's what's really quieted down a lot of the opposition to this, because there was a lot of opposition originally. Basically, if you have a project that's been in the pipeline before January 12th, and these are lots and lots of projects, you're essentially exempt from the 25% inclusionary housing requirement. Now, there are little bits of additional affordable housing you need to add, but it's very, very minor. So that basically appeased a lot of the developers who were against the project or against the proposition to begin with.
I mean, some of the developers now and some of those who want to build are kind of split on this, as we'll hear in the course of this hour. I mean, you use the word appeased. They're on board, but they're on board because of the grandfathering mainly.
Right. I mean, the big question here is, will this backfire? Where is the sweet spot for finding how much affordable housing you can actually build without running off developers altogether to the point where it's not worth it for them to build the affordable housing? Unintended consequences are always things that people talk about when we talk about housing policy here in San Francisco and our traditional, the city's traditional resistance to building.
Again, Stephanie Martin Taylor here with us in studios, anchor and housing reporter for KQED, and she laid it out very well, as I expected. Thank you, Stephanie.
Thank you.
Let me tell you who else is joining us for the hour. Jane Kim is here with us in studio, supervisor for District 6 for the city and county of San Francisco, who, along with Aaron Peskin, co-authored this legislation. Welcome,
Jane. Good
morning. I also want to welcome Sonia Trauss, who's also with us in studio, founder of the San Francisco Bay Area Renters Federation, a pro-development group. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
And we'll say good morning to Tim Colon, who is here with us as well, executive director of San Francisco Housing Action Coalition. That's a 16-year-old nonprofit supporting housing at all levels. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. We'll also say good morning to Peter Cohen, who's here with us, co-director of the Council of Community Housing Organization, which promotes the development and preservation of affordable housing in San Francisco. Welcome.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. Let me begin with Supervisor Kim. And Supervisor Kim, a lot of the opposition is, let's just put that, I suppose from your perspective, put it to rest, not where they're concerned necessarily, but it's been concern about construction costs and concern about union costs particularly, and they're saying, they said initially before the grandfathering, and some are still saying can't be done, doesn't work financially.
So, you know, a stat that often many San Franciscans don't know is actually 60% of San Francisco residents qualify for affordable housing under federal HUD guidelines. In fact, if you make under $84,550 a year, or if you're a family of four that makes under $120,000 a year, you qualify for affordable housing. Now, we need to build over 28,000 units of housing, but at least 57% of that needs to be affordable in order for us to continue to be a healthy and diverse city. And it is my job as a supervisor to push the envelope and figure out how we can achieve this goal and always ask for more. So the ballot measure that is before the voters today in June simply takes out the ceiling, as Stephanie pointed out, on what we can ask market rate developers build. And building upon our achievements from last year, where we achieved 40% affordable and middle income housing in very large projects, we're saying, you know what, we want you to build the 15% affordable housing again. And on top of that, we think that you can do 10% for middle class households. And we believe that you can
think
do it.
Based on what? I mean, what kind of studies were done to fortify that?
Well, we know from the past that we've been able to hit higher numbers than 12% and 15%. As I mentioned, we have three projects that hit 40% affordable and middle-income housing. And in the meantime, we're going to be doing a study to demonstrate what the maximum that our developers can build while continuing construction here in San Francisco.
And yet the concern seems to be that maybe some projects will be killed off. Maybe there will be more people displaced.
It's not in my interest to halt construction or development here in San Francisco. I know that we need to build more housing, but it's also my job to push the envelope to see how much more affordable and middle-class housing we can build here in San Francisco. It is a tough time here in San Francisco when we have good wage earners, office workers, nurses, teachers that can't afford to live here in San Francisco, in a city where the average median price for a home is $1.1 million. We simply have to do more. And my job is to push the envelope and see how much more we can build without halting construction. And that's what the study will be there for. And it will be completed by July 31st.
July 31st is the due date of that study to come in. Again, Jane Kim is supervisor, District 6, City and County of San Francisco. Sonia Trauss is founder of the San Francisco Bay Area Renters Federation, which is a pro-development group. And actually, you're kind of mad at some of those, that word appease again comes here. Some of those are going along with this grandfather deal, aren't you?
Yeah, I admit we feel a little betrayed by developers, but I do understand. I mean, the developers that have a project in the pipeline now are concerned with making sure that that project isn't killed. And so, you know, that's their main concern. And so by, in exchange for being grandfathered in, by not having to comply with the 25%, they basically agreed to not oppose it, to not oppose the ballot measure. But what that means is that future projects that are infeasible just will never be proposed. And that's hard on, you know, future workers, future residents, and, you know, potential future developers.
Now, I've seen figures that you and some of the developers who you're on board with have put out that say that you would actually reduce housing built with this by 13.5% and increase displacement by 4%. How do you come up with those figures?
The 13.5% comes from Ted Egan, the city economist. They did a study to see what the effect of this would be. So, yeah, per 1,000 housing units that would be built under the current 12% inclusionary, If we switch to the 25%, you would get 135 fewer housing units. And so when you don't build housing, that also causes displacement. So it's true that we would get more subsidized units under the new regime, but we would only get 96 more.
Could I get the supervisor to respond to that, Jane Kim?
You know, I asked the other side what study shows that we can't do 25% affordable middle-income housing when we've proven that we've been able to do more than 25% in previous projects. And that's what the study is here for. Ted Egan's report was a preliminary assessment, but we're actually doing the full-scale report today that's going to be able to demonstrate what the maximum that our market-rate developers can do. Our market-rate developers are making millions of dollars here in San Francisco. We can certainly ask them to share some of that profit and value with the community by building a city that's going to be accessible for more of our residents.
Sonia Trauss, you think a lot of this is political, don't you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, as far as the projects that do more than 25% all have upzonings. And we actually have a really good program, the Affordable Housing Bonus Program, that along with upzonings requires up to 30% affordable housing. So that upzoning and then asking for...
I just want to get this straight. No development has actually met Prop C requirements without upzoning?
That's right.
No, you're shaking your head no, Tim Cullen?
What we see is certainly we want the maximum production of affordable housing. That's how we approach it. The large projects can do it because they can use special rules and get additional height and financial tools that aren't available to smaller housing developments. And, you know, look, we're in an unprecedented housing affordability and displacement crisis. And if we're going to get our arms around it, we've got to dramatically increase housing production at all levels of affordability. And we would support building the maximum amount of affordable housing. And we've looked long and hard at Prop C and tried to get our arms around it and couldn't come to a conclusion. We're neutral on it. There are some very good things that it does, and that should be acknowledged at the outset. But we have real reservations and skeptical in some ways that it's going to deliver what it promises.
Again, Tim Cullen is executive director of the San Francisco Housing Action Coalition, which is a 16-year-old nonprofit which supports housing at all levels. You're also concerned about how this is going to affect the general fund, aren't you?
Well, haven't gotten that far into the weeds yet. I think we keep our eye on the ball on housing production. That's what's going to change, you know, this city, whether we remain a diverse, inclusive city or not. If we can't increase housing production, we will continue to displace the young and the middle class out of the city.
We need to know how much is going to be produced. Isn't that the bottom line here? How much housing is going to be produced?
If we want investment in housing, if we want investment to come to San Francisco for housing, there has to be a climate of certainty where the rules are known. They're not changed in the middle of the game so that if people want to take a parking lot or a one-story retail building and say that makes more sense as housing, they know what the rules are. They can make their plans. They can obtain financing and build it.
Are you reassured by the fact that July 31st there is supposed to be a full accounting here?
Yes, and that's one of the good things about Prop C that we do like. It calls for an economic feasibility analysis, but there's nothing written that we can see that says that the Board of Supervisors has to follow its recommendations or conclusions. It's in the political realm at that point, and that's how decisions are usually made.
Let's bring Peter Cohen into this. He co-directs a Council of Community Housing Organizations, which promotes the development and preservation of affordable housing in San Francisco. This trailer provision, again, it's going to be an economic feasibility analysis. Is this reassuring to you?
Well, we agree to it. I mean, I think it's just a good practice to do those kinds of analyses and tinker and make sure the number's right. I mean, going all the way back to the time when inclusionary housing was first established in 2002, there were complaints from developers back then. I remember sitting around the table with then Supervisor Mark Leno, who was really the father of San Francisco's inclusionary housing. And you thought the sky was going to fall, and we ended up with 12%. And guess what? Development increased immediately after that was put into place because it does establish a level of certainty. Then again in 2007, the proposal was to raise it to 15. The sky was going to fall again. We heard the developers complaining and complaining, and yet when that went into place, development increased. So I think this is sort of a normal drill, but at that the same time, we've done those kinds of analyses, and I think it's going to happen. I think I want to point to another study, if that's where we are right now, is the city does have what's called a nexus study, Michael. It shows what the actual need is that's created by market rate housing. Keep in mind, inclusionary is essentially a mitigation for the demand for affordable housing that's created. It should be 25% to 30% to fully mitigate the affordable housing need created by market rate housing. Is that actually feasible from a market standpoint? I think that's what this study is going to ask. But the need's out there and the nexus is very clear.
And you now have, what, about 9,000 units in the pipeline?
Yeah, I was actually just looking at that before we came over. There are actually 14,000 housing units that are already entitled. That means they've gotten their approvals. And what's interesting is out of that 14,000, only 16% of them are affordable. The remainder are all market rate. So we, pointing to Supervisor Kim's reference to the housing element, we have a need for 57% of all our housing to be affordable at various levels. We're so out of balance compared to the numbers I just mentioned to you when 86% of all our entitled housing is market rate. We have to do something to raise that bar as high as we can. And this is trying to push that envelope.
Antonia Trouse, you want in here?
Yeah, the Nexus study doesn't show that new market rate housing creates a need for affordable housing. It just doesn't. It starts out with the assumption that the high income people that move into new housing would not have moved here if that new housing wasn't created. And that assumption flies in the face of normal reason and everyone's experience.
You want to respond to that, Peter Cohen? On the Nexus study?
Sure. I mean, these are official studies that the city's done and has used for many years to establish and essentially give backup to its affordable housing inclusionary policies. Most cities have these. So, I mean, I guess Sonia could quibble with the methodology, but this is what we have. And I don't think we want to be doing a technical analysis of studies. It's as much to think about the policy situation we're in and what the market is producing and, frankly, the dramatic changing face of San Francisco that we're trying to correct. That's really what's at stake here.
Well, let me go back to Supervisor Kim. Hasn't Mayor Lee said, or it came out of the mayor's office at least, that there would be a kind of killing the creation of 2,100 units, which would mean certainly big losses in construction and so forth?
The mayor has fully endorsed the measure that is before us today, along with 11 members of the Board of Supervisors. And I don't think the average resident needs to see a study to know that we are displacing working class and middle class residents. So whatever study is out there, we see that we are losing our middle class and our working class here in San Francisco, and we have to do more. And developers can be a part of that solution. Yes, the city can put in more funding towards affordable housing. Yes, the state can put in more money towards affordable housing, and we are doing that. And we thank the voters for passing a $350 million affordable housing bond last November. But we also want developers to do their share as well. As they are constructing market rate and luxury housing, they can certainly do a little bit more to contribute to affordable middle income units. And we have seen them do it. You've seen three projects last year that hit 40%. Yes, they are the larger projects, but we believe that the medium-sized projects can do more too.
But Tim Coleman, if I go back to you, there's a developer named Oz Erickson who's been very much in the spotlight in all this and says, this is well-intentioned, but the figures, especially when you put it in the highest mark in the United States, are impossible because of union labor costs.
Well, you know, it's no secret San Francisco has stratospheric construction costs. That, too, is a huge factor that threatens housing production. But on the 25%, as Stephanie mentioned earlier, that is the highest rate in the United States. It's higher than New York City. And as to where it came from, why 25% and not 50% or 75%, they're equally valid and had just as much analysis as 25%. It seems to have been pulled.
Does it seem arbitrary to you?
Yeah. Yes, it does.
Yeah. Jane Kim, you say what to that?
Well, this was the same argument that we heard when we raised the inclusionary housing to 12% and again 15%. Developers cried wolf and said this is going to halt all construction here in San Francisco. They said the number was arbitrary. They said it was the highest in the country. And then not only did we achieve it, we built more housing after that, more market rate housing after that. I simply don't agree, and I think that we should wait and see until the study comes out on July 31st, and that is exactly what this measure does.
Are we putting Peter Cohen the cart before the horse here? I mean, there was really no public review or analysis. You were mentioning, studies and so forth, but we need more than that, as the trailer thing indicates, yeah?
I mean, I think this is the way public policy can work, is you want to set a goal and, you know, the responsible approach then is to study that and we can tinker with it.
It's a little like a negotiation.
Yeah, it's a negotiation. But I mean, you know, look, we are in a crisis. Another word has been used over and over and over. But if you look at the numbers historically, we have not seen this level of rent escalation and displacement ever. And so we can't just work around, nibble around the edges. We have to set a very aggressive bar and we have to work toward that. And we'll do the studies. The land costs and the development assumptions will shift. That's what markets do. The grandfathering was very, very important. I don't want to have anyone underestimate how important that was, because those projects have vested interests. Their financing's been locked up. And so I think, frankly, the grandfathering is extremely generous. And it's quite similar to what's been done in the previous two rounds of the inclusionary. What we're talking about is the future and how we expect the market and developers to adjust to future policy expectations. And we'll study that. But I think this is a very reasonable outcome.
Well, speaking about the future, Sonia Trauss, what about going before the Board of Supervisors to get approval? I mean, how does that strike you? If indeed this passes in, we're talking about actually the June 7th primary, and then goes on the ballot in November and passes in November, you're going to have to have agreement by the Board of Supervisors in terms of what percentages of affordable housing, essentially.
Yeah, it's going to be hard for supervisors to reduce the 25%. You know, to something that's more workable. And I have to point out, I don't think anyone claims that 25% or 12% will kill all projects. The claim is that it kills marginal projects. It kills projects with a low profit margin. And low profit margin projects are the projects that we most want, because they're the projects that are in the sunset, you know, that are relatively more modest housing. And it may be the case that development went up after the first time that, you know, we instituted 12%. But the question isn't whether it went up compared to before 12%. The question is, how much more would it have gone up if we didn't have the 12%? And that's something that we can't see. But what we can see, actually, is after having 15 years of an inclusionary policy, not only is our housing problem worse, we now have to subsidize middle-income people. And I think that's a failure of our housing policy. And I think that inclusionary is one of the parts of our housing policy that has clearly failed. We are in a worse position now than we have ever been.
Let me go to Tim Colon on this, since he's the neutral voice here.
I'd like to go back to this sky is falling and crying wolf about this. We have to deal with the city as it is. Look, the facts are San Francisco is, because of its red-hot economy, is growing by 10,000 residents a year. We have an economy that's the envy of the United States. We're attracting lots and lots of people here to a city that is very, very stingy in how it produces housing. We have a terrible record of that. So when we're talking about reducing housing production, if it reduces it a little bit, that's a lot in a city that badly needs it. Our historic production runs 1,500, 1,700, 1,800 units a year. That's not inadequate to solve the problems we face.
Well, San Francisco's Prop C would require more affordable housing. You may want to weigh in on this subject that we're debating here, that is Prop C on the June ballot, which would require 25% of units in new large and medium-sized residential buildings be offered at below market rates, and if passed, the measure would make San Francisco the city with the most stringent affordable housing mandate in the nation. Join us now at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle, @KQEDForum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're discussing and debating San Francisco Prop C as part of our election coverage. It would require more affordable housing. It would up it, in fact, from its present 12% rate to 25% rate. And we're talking with Jane Kim, supervisor for District 6, who's co-author of the ballot measure, and Sonia Trauss, who is founder of the San Francisco Bay Area Renters Federation, a pro-development group. Tim Colon, also with us this morning for this hour, executive director of the San Francisco Housing Action Coalition, and Peter Cohen, who co-directs the Council of Community Housing Organizations. And we do welcome your involvement in the program. All lines are full, but when one becomes available, make it yours. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Let me go to your calls right away here. Let's begin, Jack, with you. Good morning, Jack.
Good morning, Jack. Yeah, hi, good morning. I just have a quick comment. I'm kind of wondering what the political kind of establishment is thinking in some ways. You know, as soon as you increase the minimum number of affordable housing units in these large projects, it's, you know, it's not like the projects aren't going to happen. It's just that the projects are going to be more expensive for the market rates. So what happens then, right? Well, the developers, they're just going to upmarket and sell their products to, you know, even higher and higher end clientele. And what's going to happen then? Everyone from China and everyone else who wants to take their money out of their country is going to wind up buying here, and they might not even be, like, live here anymore. So you're going to wind up with all these towers that are empty, and it just doesn't seem like a very good use of space.
Thank you for the question, Jack. Let's go to Supervisor Kim.
So my response to that is developers are always going to charge the highest rent or home sale price that they can, regardless of how much affordable or middle-income housing that they're building. And I just want to clarify what market rate is today. Market rate, and this is not luxury, this is not the Millennium, this is not the Four Seasons. Market rate for your average condo that is being built today is built for a family of four that is making $270,000 a year. And developers will continue to charge the maximum that the market can bear. And they will do that whether they are building 40% affordable middle-income housing or whether they're building 10% affordable middle-income housing. I don't believe that prices are going to come down if inclusionary comes down. That being said, what we will be doing now that we are setting the new future of what we expect developers to build is that land prices will go down. And that is why we did grandfathering. We acknowledge that developers that had already started the process were starting under a different set of rules. So we acknowledge that and we grandfather them. We still ask them to do a little bit more than they were obligated to do, and they agreed, all of them. And now we're saying this is the new regime. This is the expectation moving forward. As you make your deals and you buy land, you know what the value of what you are purchasing is. So land prices will come down.
We'll have Sonia Truss respond to that, but first I'm looking at a question here that I'm going to go to you with, again, Jane Kim. Lucas writes, why is this a ballot measure? How come the supervisors cannot take this on themselves?
I wish we could, but this is in the city charter that we have set a ceiling on how much we can ask market rate developers to build. So the only group that can change this are the voters of San Francisco, and that is why we are going to the voters. And I would ask those that are opposing Proposition C if they actually support keeping us at the maximum of 12%, if that is enough, if developers cannot do more.
Actually, that question can go to you, Sonia Truss, as well as you may want to respond to what the supervisor said initially here.
Yeah, staying at 12% is fine. And if we want to go up to more, 25, 30%, we can couple it with an upzoning, which is actually something before the Board of Supervisors. That's the Affordable Housing Bonus Program. That's an upzoning plus an increased requirement for affordable housing. And that is something that is definitely feasible. As far as, the caller, what I want to reconcile what the caller was saying, with what Jane was saying, one thing is that land prices really can't go down very much because almost all of the land that might be turned into housing actually is already in productive use. So if you have a parking lot or if you have one-story commercial, that generates revenue. And so there is definitely a point above which building something, you know, if you have to give away half of your building, is just not going to get you more money than continuing to use it as parking. So land prices are not going to necessarily go down.
One of the reasons
just Tim Cullen, go ahead.
One of the reasons we're skeptical about Prop C is that as Sonia says, if you raise the price above some point, we're not sure that land sales will happen. And the landowner will say, well, sure, I'll just cut my land price 40% when they already have a cash generating use on it. But more troubling is that it makes, for a city that so badly needs housing, it makes hotel uses or office uses more financially attractive. And the risk is we start, the market makes a decision, we get less housing, but offices and hotels increase.
Peter Cohen.
Yeah, I mean, just you're hearing the presumption again that this is somehow going to stifle the market. I just disagree based on historical experience. But the caller also, the second caller, had a really good point about why don't we just do this legislatively. Frankly, this should have been done probably 2 years ago. It's one of the critiques that we hear is why in 2016? Why not in 2013 or 2014 when clearly – the real estate market rebounded, but we couldn't. We tried. We wanted our supervisors to do it, wanted the mayor to do it, just simply couldn't do it. It was locked up in the ballot. Meanwhile, what we've had is 3,500 units of new construction year over year in 2014 and 2015. And I just want to point out, put that in historical reference, San Francisco has not had that level of new construction since the early 1960s, when urban renewal was bulldozing neighborhoods and building high rises. Now, that's not what this is, but just to give us an idea, it has been 50 years since we've had this level of construction. Sonia and Tim might not think it's enough, but we're actually way beyond our historical experience and trying to grapple with that. There's some huge social and economic implications of doing that. So let's make sure we can handle what we're doing now with this volume before we assume it's not enough.
We'll go to more of your calls.
Those 2 years that we produced 3,500 units of housing, the city's population increased by 20,000.
And you say what to that? Peter,
this isn't just about meeting population change, which happens in a very short period of time. As Tim and Sonia know, it takes probably 3 to 5 years for housing construction to actually be completed. So we're always going to have a lag time in how construction of housing can keep up with population growth. And population growth has wild swings. So again, my point is, if we're looking at the rate of production as somehow being stingy, I think was the word Tim used, we've actually nearly tripled the rate of production in a very, very short period of time. And that has tremendous policy implications that we have to grapple with. And we can't just act recklessly.
All right, let me bring up more callers here. Let me go to John, who's calling us from Oakland. John, go ahead.
Hey, I just want to make a couple of points. Let's see. The first one is that, I mean, I'm standing here wearing my tool belt. I'm a building contractor. And the first point is that affordable housing doesn't really cost that much less to build than market rate or luxury housing, the only difference being the location and some cosmetic touches or landscaping. But the second point is, one often overlooked thing that really drives up the cost of housing is the bureaucratic red tape and bungling and all these people with their hands out. I mean, look at the city of Berkeley. How many people had to die last year because they can't even inspect a balcony? And it took my client 13 months to get a permit, you know, with a top-notch architect and engineer just to replace a foundation under a cheap bungalow. What do you guys have to say to that? Thanks. I'll take it off the air.
All right. We thank you for the call, John. Who wants to speak first? Supervisor Kim.
One of the things that I just want to say is San Francisco is one of the few counties in the state that's actually meeting its housing production goals. And I think everyone in this room can agree that the region, frankly, needs to do more. So we can blame policies that are going on in San Francisco, but we have to understand that the entire Bay Area region needs to build more housing. Mm-hmm. We need Palo Alto and Mountain View and other cities and jurisdictions to build more housing. They are also creating more jobs. And frankly, those workers are coming to San Francisco because this is where we are building housing. So it is not just San Francisco alone. We need to push the entire region to do more.
Apropos of those remarks, I want to go to another caller who's calling us from Sonoma, who is saying, well, they've got the crisis up there, too, because the Bay Area is moving up there. Go ahead. Jackie, you're on the air. Jackie, are you there? Okay. We'll try one more time. Jackie.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, no, I can. Go ahead.
Okay, sorry about that. I live in Sonoma County, and there's a major housing crisis up here. We can't get housing for caregivers, for social workers. You know, I can't pretend to know the solution, but idealistically, I'd like for some people, whether it's builders or homeowners, or to feel some kind of social responsibility to not have these rents or properties be so expensive. It's insane.
Okay. We thank you, Jackie, for weighing in. I want to have more listeners weigh in. In fact, let me go to some questions that are coming to us on our website. You can add your voice by going to kqed.org/forum or calling us toll-free number 866-733-6786. Sally writes, hasn't the problem with affordable housing been that it isn't economically feasible for developers? I hear from real estate friends that the existing affordability restrictions on new rental units has led to the current condo boom. Do condos have fewer restrictions? Can we go to you on that, Tim Cullen? Yeah.
As I understand the question, no, it's both to condos and rentals. Condos have equally heavy exactions put on them by our rules. And Yeah. We have to understand there's not a person anywhere that disagrees we need more affordable housing. It's absolutely at crisis levels. But we're talking about it doesn't cost a nickel less to build an affordable unit as a market rate one. We're talking $700,000-$800,000 to deliver an affordable unit for a very, very small number of people. We're between a rock and a hard place.
You know, it's interesting, Michael. Just
Peter Cohen.
I respect Tim's perspective, but the way he framed it and he called it an exaction. I mean, it's correct, number one. Technically, inclusionary housing applies to rentals or condos either way. And most developers take out a condo map on a rental so they can flip it anytime they want. But keeping in mind, what does the inclusionary on condos do? It provides a first-time home ownership opportunity. We have about 2,000 inclusionary units that have now been produced in San Francisco since 2002, since Leno first put the policy in place. About a third of them are condos. These have been one of the only opportunities for first-time home ownership for a lot of folks. These are families making $80,000, $90,000 a year and a little bit above. That's an absolute golden opportunity. To call it an exaction, we're actually providing for folks who can put roots down in this city.
Let me go back to you, Sonia Trous, if I may, with a question from a tweeter, from one of our listeners on Twitter. Can developers pay cash to avoid the mandate for affordable housing units?
Pay cash?
That's the question.
Oh, and in lieu fee. Oh, yeah. Yeah, they can pay in lieu fees.
Okay. Let's get that on the record, and let's get another caller as well. Jason, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me. Actually, that was a perfect segue into my question.
Jason, you're breaking up. We have to get a better line. I'm sorry about that. Let me get another caller on here. This is Wes. Wes, go ahead.
Hi. I'm wondering if the new proposition allows for, say, like tax breaks or subsidies that kind of make this a little more feasible for the developers.
Yeah, Jane Kim.
Well, first of all, we don't know that this is not feasible. That is why we are doing a study. And I believe that market rate developers can do more. And we have seen this already in the last year and a half that market rate developers can do far more than the 12% that they are currently required to do today. And I just want to agree with Sonia, actually, that, there may be some projects that can't do 25%. And if that study shows that smaller projects in the Sunset can't do 25%, we'll set a different rate. But in the south of Market, where we are building bigger and taller, and we find that projects can do 25% or can do 30%, we will change those obligations. And so what the study will actually be able to do is use a fine-tooth comb and actually set perhaps different rates for different types of developments in different neighborhoods. And that's why I think the board will approve a new rate, because some projects will be able to do 25% for certainty.
Sonia Trous?
No, I'm actually really excited about the idea of having different inclusionary in different parts of – in different circumstances, basically. We do know for a fact that some projects are made infeasible by the 25%. And we know that because the grandfathering exists. If everything was feasible with 25%, our supervisors that care very much about maximizing the amount of affordable housing would have just maximized it. And nothing would have been killed. But if they had actually done that, projects in progress would have been killed.
And again, Sonia Trous is co-founder of the San Francisco Bay Area Renters Federation, the Arrow Pro Development Group. Here's Tina, who writes, do any of your guests live in a mixed-income housing unit? In my experience, these units tend to have many problems. It's like a restaurant that tries to be both a McDonald's and a French Laundry. There's a constant tension between the tenants. Isn't there a better solution to affordable housing than mixed-income units?
We disagree with that. I think mixed-income communities are successful, and they're what we aspire to.
Yeah, and I would agree with Tim. I mean, this is, I think, one public policy goal that we should be agreeing on. It's interesting. The word inclusionary housing is root word inclusion, and it comes actually from some Supreme Court cases that fought back against exclusionary zone and exclusionary housing. Most of us aspire to live in a neighborhood that has a lot of different kind of folks. That's a kind of inherent interest, especially in urban living. So mixed income development actually works quite well.
You don't buy that metaphor of McDonald's and French Laundry.
No, this is integration. This woman is describing her having difficulty with desegregation. And integration is very hard. Actually, the United States never did it. But I still think it's worth doing. I think everybody here agrees it's worth it.
Well, it's also worth hearing from more of our listeners because a lot of them want to be heard from here. Nori, you're on the air. Good morning. I'm sorry. I think you're talking. No, we're having some problems here with some of these phones. It's more like tin cans. Let me get a caller on from San Francisco. John, you're on.
I'm a San Francisco native, And I've 40 years in construction as a carpenter and a contractor. And just from what I've seen in the past, it seems that most of the affordable housing that is made available usually goes to the contractor's family or friends or the project manager's family or friends. And I'll take your comment off the air. Thank you.
Okay. I don't. You're shaking your head no here, Tim Cullen.
Disagree. There's a really rigorous process through the mayor's office of housing that vets the applicants and makes sure of their award. I've never heard of that before.
Never heard of any nepotism or any thing even approaching intimating?
I've heard it alleged. I've never, ever seen it proved.
It's a flat-out lottery system, and the lottery is public. You can actually go into 10 as they pull the numbers out of a jar. And so to claim nepotism, I think, would be very challenging to do in those public scenarios.
And we'll get Betty on next. Betty, welcome. You're on the air.
Thank you, and thank you for your awesome program. My question is for Jane Kim regarding the legislation proposed with Prop C. In November of last year, your legislation passed, upping the percentage of affordable housing from up to 25% on San Francisco public-owned land. However, it is common practice for the City of San Francisco and the Board of Supervisors to ignore the San Francisco Surplus City Property Ordinance, as you did with the 70 acres of San Francisco public-owned land at Yerba Buena Island. And my question is, for legacy displaced people within your own district that you've ignored, such as the YBI residents and the South of Market, South Beach residents, what is your intent, not only with Prop C and upping the amount of development in large developments to provide housing for those displaced people within your own district? And the second question is, before the board this week is a giant, mostly market-rate housing project in the Tenderloin. The Planning Commission has approved the 304-unit building, which will offer only 36 affordable units. Historically, you've negotiated higher affordable housing percentages for new buildings. Increased to 25 or 30% of those units, it would still only be 76 to 91 units. Will you support this project? And if yes, would you create priority placement for those D6 residents displaced last year? Thank you.
All right. That's quite a brief. Go ahead, Jane.
Betty, it's good to hear from you. I'm really proud of the fact that in the district that I represent, which is only 1/11 of the city, that we are building 56% of all of San Francisco's affordable housing. And that really speaks to both my predecessor and my work in making sure that we are setting new standards every single year in the amount of affordable middle-income housing that we're building. And for the very first time last year, we won middle-class housing. We won housing for households that make between $80,000 and $150,000 a year. We're going to see this in the Giants parking lot in Seawall Lot 337. We're going to see this on 5th and Mission. And we're going to see this at 160 Folsom. And these are going to be home ownership units. So I will continue to fight to make sure that we are setting new standards. And we did pass legislation last year that does give neighborhood preference. So if the affordable housing is being built in your neighborhood, you get preference for those units.
Let me read a couple of comments that are coming in here. Marcy writes, all of the middle class have left the city. Who's left to vote? Those who don't want them back? And Keith writes, we in Marin County and other parts of the Bay Area are deeply affected by the lack of housing, affordable or otherwise, in San Francisco. I recently took a bike ride from the Presidio down to Hunters Point and was stunned to see acres and acres of abandoned warehouse and port facilities no longer in use. The massive post office facilities and rusting fleet of trucks need to be relocated or closed. San Francisco needs to have a massive urban redevelopment effort and build housing for its local workforce. Tim Cullen, that's
amen to that. You know, yeah. This is about land use choices, and we're still grappling with what to do with our dilapidated waterfront. And, you know, the Prop B passed recently that tries to take it – makes it much harder to do. And, you know, gosh, we've got rules in San Francisco, land use rules and policy rules that exist in no other U.S. city. That's why the Housing Action Coalition was formed. And it is about having the courage to take land that once had an industrial or commercial use that no longer makes sense and imagine a project that makes a vibrant community where one doesn't exist now. And if we're going to get around this housing crisis, we're going to have to do a better job of that.
You know, population has been mentioned before, and in a sense, we are constantly struggling and lagging behind that, aren't we? That's the reality here, isn't it?
Well, yeah. Going back to the argument about that Peter mentioned about inclusionary, yes, San Francisco should pat itself on the back. We do a pretty decent job of building subsidized low-income housing, but this 2,000 units that we've built in our history that Peter mentioned, that's 142 units a year. If it were 10 times that much, it wouldn't be enough. We're stuck with solutions that don't scale to the challenge that we're facing.
We also are stuck with the fact that you have so many city employees who simply can't afford to live here. You have teachers and you have police officers and firefighters and so forth who literally cannot afford to live in this city. And again, let me remind you that Tim Colon is executive director of the San Francisco Housing Action Coalition, and they are a nonprofit that support housing at all levels. They've been around for 16 years. And let me try to get another caller in here.
Can I just jump in on that, though, Michael?
Yeah, go ahead, Peter Cohen.
Because, you know, we talk about middle income and Tim's point about inclusionary. I mean, you know, we can all define middle class however we want to. It's probably a very wide swath. But we have a tremendous middle income in San Francisco right now. 62% of our population is from folks who have literally no income to singles and families up around the median, which is 100% of the area median income. That's the bulk of San Francisco's population. We do have a middle income in San Francisco, and they're extremely vulnerable to displacement. And so this Prop C measure, in fact, is targeting that population because that's where our missing middle is. That's where our need is, both for keeping folks here and also providing new housing opportunities. So I just want to make sure that we're not assuming somehow that San Francisco's middle class is gone.
And you
are growing in population. Just one other thing is the population growth is interesting. We're gaining a tremendous amount of population of families above $100,000 a year in income, and we are losing almost an equal number of families below that level.
Let me remind you that you are listening to Forum. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to more of your calls. Let me go to Millbrae next. Daniel, thanks for waiting. Join us.
Hi. I'd like to understand how housing, you know, I understand that initially you'll be affordable, but on secondary market, you just become market rate when you resell the property. And the only way a rental unit can stay affordable is through subsidies by the taxpayers. It's just, that just doesn't seem sustainable. I'd like to take that off the air.
Okay.
So that is just not true.
Supervisor Kim.
That's not true. Once a affordable unit for home ownership is put up for sale, when it is sold again, it has to be sold as an affordable unit again. These units are deed restricted, and that is true for the rental units as well. And the rental units that are inclusionary housing are not subsidized at all by taxpayer dollars. They are 100% subsidized by the market rate developers in perpetuity.
Let me get another caller on, and that's James, who is a developer joining us from Emeryville. James, welcome.
Yes. Well, you know, it's been danced around quite a bit, but the thing is the math of the project has to work. And if you're building a unit that costs $800,000 to build, you can only sell it for $240,000. That means the remaining units have to be able to make up not only that $500,000 for those, but then there's, you know, taxes and everything else that go with those other sales, the sale of those remaining units. So come on, and no one's addressing both sides of the mathematical equation. Tim had a good point about scaling. You need to be able to scale the projects to be able to produce more, because how many millions of people are there, and you're only getting 146 units a year? You know, that's kind of like trying to spit on a, you know, an apartment.
I didn't realize all these multi-million dollar developers needed so much advocacy to protect their bottom line. We know that these developers are making money while they build affordable and middle-income housing. And yes, they make up for it from the immense amount of money that they are selling and renting in these market rate units, again, which are set on average for households of four that make $270,000 a year. Not that many San Franciscans can afford that, but they are paying more of their income to live here in San Francisco. And we're trying to address that by building more affordable middle-income housing. And the one thing I do want to say that everyone in this room agrees, and I want to thank SF BARF and the Housing Action Coalition for this, is that we're all working together to protect tenants in existing rent control units, because we know that just as important as it is to create and build more affordable housing, we also need to protect and keep tenants that are currently in rent controlled units in place stable.
Yeah, Sonia Trouse.
Yeah, I mean, I love talking about protecting existing affordable housing. In addition to rent-controlled housing in San Francisco, other sources of affordable housing are housing in places like West Oakland or the Bayview used to be affordable. One of the ways that affordable housing is destroyed, the main way, is when you have more high-income people than new housing for them. I mean, a high-income person shopping for a otherwise cheap apartment will make that apartment expensive because the landlord will charge, you know, they'll see his shoes and they'll be like, I know what I can charge now. And for me, that's why building high-income housing, building new expensive housing, that's how you protect existing affordable housing in existing lower-income neighborhoods.
I'd like a little history's in order here. You know, yes, now we're in a kind of frothy part of the market, although evidence is it's cooling off a little bit. But we'd do well to recall that probably less than 5 years ago, housing production in San Francisco came to a complete standstill, effective standstill. Unemployment was spiking. There was no housing being produced in a year. And guess what? In which population went up by 10,000. So we're in cycles here. And the idea is to focus on the long term and produce a sustained amount of housing that's going to take the pressure off these insane 10 to 15% per year price increases, which is it's not sustainable for a city that wants to remain inclusive.
It is definitely not sustainable. And let me read a couple more comments. Aaron tweets, as a San Francisco business owner, my experience is that it is difficult to recruit and retain quality employees due to rising housing costs. And here's Alex in Panola who writes, what about Marin County? They preserve a very nice lifestyle with low or no growth policies and lots of open land, but then most of them drive into San Francisco for high-paying jobs. Why not press them and other surrounding counties
Amen.
To do their share?
Absolutely.
All right. To get agreement from all of you saying amen, can't do better than that, I suppose. But let me thank all of you. Jane Kim, again, a supervisor, District 6. Sonia Trouse, founder of the San Francisco Bay Area Renters Federation, and Tim Colan is Executive Director of San Francisco Housing Action Coalition, and Peter Cohen is Co-Director of the Council of Community Housing Organizations. Thank you all for being here, and Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and we got online support from Amanda Font. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, executive producer Joanne Wallace, and for all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.